Hello, it is Liam Schmidt here from Irish Funds. We are delighted to bring to you the next podcast episode from our recent Irish Funds annual conference. In this keynote address, Sonia Loud, Chief Investment Officer of Legal & General Investment Management, will convey the CIO's perspective under the title of Rising Rates, Recession Risks, Geopolitics and Regulatory Change, The New Normal. I'm sure you will find the insights to be fascinating, and do keep an eye out for further podcasts shortly from the Irish Funds Annual Conference 2023.
Thank you very much for the very kind introduction. It's a great honour to be here to speak about, you know, quite a number of topics. And the reason actually is straightforward, because we've all gotten used to a rate of change that clearly ever since the start of the pandemic has not only felt relentless, it has been relentless. And I think every year we start again and hope that it might slow down, but it doesn't. And this is why, again, I've been listing here that the number of topics that clearly will be on everyone's mind, and investors need to make sure they understand how they can all fit this together in a view of what's going to happen next. And clearly the regulatory change, I hope we will all agree, has clearly been keeping us on our toes as well, in order to put a particularly focus on sustainable investing. Here we go. So what I would like to do in the next 20 minutes or so is really going through these topics one by one, because I always feel that this is the only way how you can make sure you understand the key drivers and challenges that will determine the key ingredients that will form not only the economic outlook, but clearly will be the key ingredients for us to understand where markets will be heading next. And although this is a nice interconnected framework here, again, I said it's always important to my mind to understand what the individual drivers underneath each individual are. So if we start, obviously, inflation has been the main driver, not only last year, but for actually a bit longer now. And yet again, since the beginning of the year, it is the trying to understand the kind of payoff between core inflation and headline inflation, and what will ultimately drive the central bank reaction function that has been on investors' mind. Sorry, can I keep my slides here? Because looking at myself is not, I mean, it's nice, but still. So the inflationary picture is still, to my mind, key to understand in order to decipher the central bank reaction function, and in order to get to the bottom of that. The second is the economic picture, and how much, obviously, the balance between inflation and the inevitable slowdown will play out this year. We've called out, obviously, consumption and corporate earnings, but at the end of the day, what we're looking for is how well interest rate hikes are having an impact on the underlying economic activity, and then likewise, obviously, will feed back into the monetary central bank reaction function. Now, if we look at inflation, then we have had a lot of attention and a lot of headlines on the headline inflation. And obviously, as you can see here, on the left is the Eurozone, on the right is the US. We have seen, obviously, dramatic shifts downwards in headline inflation. Not surprisingly, this is predominantly driven by energy prices and core goods prices, and they that were the ones during the pandemic that have obviously driven headline inflation upwards. So that's not surprising. What is the far more interesting part is core inflation, and you see both for Europe and the US that this proves far stickier than originally anticipated. So the idea of transitory clearly does not apply to core inflation, and this is what worries central banks. And if we now add the labor market dynamics to it, then we know that this might take actually quite a bit longer to normalize than originally anticipated. And don't forget, if you look at current market pricing, then we do definitely assume first Fed cuts by the end of the year. But I think we have to be very clear for the Fed to be able to do this, you need to see core inflation, in particular the big blue block at the bottom, that's services inflation. If this is not coming down towards 2%, I would struggle to see how the Fed can start cutting rates towards the end of the year. And therein lies a little bit the conundrum, because we are still talking about the idea of a soft landing or a no landing. Services inflation will not come down if we do not have a recession. But I will come to the market reaction function a bit later, because it is really, really interesting to see how this is all playing out in markets right now. But our core view at LGIM is that we do not expect core inflation to approach target of central banks, and this applies both to Europe and the US this year or even next. Now, what is equally interesting is, when I've just mentioned the idea of the soft landing or the no landing, is that you know, if you look back in history, there is no evidence that a rate hike cycle of the speed and magnitude, as we have seen it last year, has not led to either a recession or a financial crisis or both. So when I believe in this no landing or soft landing scenario, then I have to ask, how can we square that circle when, in fact, historically, we know there's a time lag. Interest rates have never worked instantaneously. But with a time lag, there has always been the relevant impact, obviously, on the economy. And obviously, we had the banking stresses earlier this year. So we have to assume that this time is not different and that, in fact, interest rates will work as we expect. And that brings me now then to the economy. Because clearly the idea of a soft landing and that we can, you know, construct this somehow, you know, implies that we can avoid what history tells us interest rate hikes are doing. Now, if we look at the key ingredients, and you see on the left is the so-called Senior Loan Officer Survey. And on the back of the recent banking stresses, you see a significant tightening of lending standards, i.e. banks no longer are willing to lend to the economy. And that, as you can see on the right, has a direct impact on economic activity. And I cannot see any reason why this relationship shouldn't work this time. And if you look at this chart here, some might have assumed that on the back of the particular regional banking stresses in the US, you would have seen even a further tightening. But I wouldn't rule out that once we get to the debt ceiling, and rest assured this will come up in a minute, you might see see a much greater interconnectedness between all these factors that might further accelerate the downward trend in the economy. Because what you're seeing here are de facto rate hikes, additional rate hikes that will slow down the economy. Because what the banks are doing is literally helping the Fed in slowing down economic activity by no longer providing sufficient credit to the economy. So if you look at this, and don't read it all in detail, this is the LGIM snapshot of our kind of recession watch. So you're looking for the key indicators of the economy to see what the rate of change is and in which direction they're heading. And you see very clearly there on the right where it says latest that the reds, unfortunately, are far too dominant for us to get comfortable that this is not leading to a recession. This is not necessarily consensus. This is very, very interesting. You still see this balancing argument between, oh, maybe we can construct a soft landing. We have kept it very simple in our analysis since the beginning of the year. If the economy indeed is more resilient, inflation will not decelerate, that it will give the Fed comfort not to hike further. We can't see a scenario where you can have it both. Right? A resilient economy and inflation coming down. It doesn't work because the US in particular is really at the last innings of its cycle, where inflationary pressures naturally arise. So without the whole distortion that we have seen on the back of the pandemic, the end of cycle is an inflationary backdrop. And as such, you know, you have something has to give eventually. And our guess is it will be the economy. And this is why I've just put on the Senior Loan Officer Survey, because the banks will help with that trajectory. Why is that so important for us as investors? Because the markets don't really seem to believe that this is indeed happening. So there's two charts really. So you have to look at the annotations at the bottom, because one is literally cut off is October last year. Because October last year you have seen a much better environment for risk assets that has led and really got us through the winter pretty much until now. And there were two reasons predominantly. If you recall here, the news flow in October last year was pretty much, oh my God, where's the blackouts going to be? How bad is it going to be in Europe? And can we really get through the winter? And it hasn't materialized. The winter was incredibly mild. Gas prices came down. So the immediate crisis has been averted. And that was already enough if you consider, obviously, how bleak the outlook was back in the autumn of 2022 to provide a good backdrop for risk assets. The second driver was China. Because you recall the real flip in their COVID policy meant the reopening was brought forward. And so you had two really important factors that allowed literally people to calm down and say, okay, maybe we can get through that without a major catastrophe. But having said that, we're now looking at valuation levels, particularly for equities. And I know I'm generalizing here because I know there's been a lot going on across sectors and not what I'm saying is just on the headline level of the indices. But if you look where we are, there's no recession priced in. There's not even, for the time being, a real kind of stress level seen with regards to the debt ceiling debate or a potential real shift in politics in the US. And that's where we remain very cautious on risk assets because we don't think that this is an adequate level to engage in risk assets currently based on the levels we currently are. So what is the trigger? I've mentioned it already, we very strongly believe that the debt ceiling clearly has the potential to create a lot of volatility in markets. You can read at your own leisure how many different scenarios there are. I hear very often, and this is interesting because markets are not stressed yet. And I hear very often, yes, because we've been here before. And yes, we have. It's not the first time that the US is really going down to the wire to agree to raise the debt ceiling. What is unusual though, point one, is the timing and is the political backdrop. Because if you consider the very weak position of the speaker and the gap that you find between the Republicans and the Democrats, that is clearly different to what we had last time. We're looking for a gap of $1.5 trillion. So it's not a small amount. You see, there is the idea of payment prioritization. You will have heard Janet Yellen calling out the 1st of June as the potential date where this can get critical. We don't believe that this is necessarily the so-called X date, but that within that time window, markets will be a lot more sensitive to the news flow from Washington. And it clearly has the potential, not necessarily, and as you can see, the outright default is below 1%. We believe it's even less. But that's not the point. It's that markets currently do not price any of these stresses. I'm saying markets are not pricing. One market does. That's the US CDS. So it's the obviously your credit default swap. And you do see a level of stress. And if you compare July 2011, was the last time we have had a similar episode. And you see in the level of the CDS, I think is a reflection of the current situation and a reflection obviously of the political backdrop we're looking at. So it has not gone unnoticed, but not across the broad asset spectrum. When I bring this all together, then you can see very clearly that we are cautious. Not cautious in the context that we don't think that this is insurmountable, but we very clearly believe you will have a better entry point into risk assets at a later point this year. We do believe that the US will enter recession, and when we look at the underlying data, then at least we're already seeing the slowdown. We particularly believe that corporate earnings and earnings revisions will turn negative, more negative than they currently are. But this is related. If we assume that obviously the economy will slow down further, then inevitably earnings revisions will come down further. And as such, we would stay away from risk at the moment. So it's a very clear positioning. We've had this since the beginning of the year. For the very simple reason that I've outlined, you just can't have it all. Something has to give at one point. And it's an adjustment process that so far is unfolding as we would expect. And obviously, having mentioned the debt ceiling, we don't think that the banking stresses in the US regional banks is behind us. And although it is clearly been concentrated in very specific and idiosyncratic cases, there's more to come. And this is based on the simple assumption we have had such a long period of time of extremely accommodative monetary policy. We cannot assume that the adjustment process is done in 12 months. So if we are really turning around and we will see interest rates higher for longer, then the adjustment process will be a longer one as well. Because we got used, the system got used to very cheap capital for a very long period of time. So weaning ourselves off cheap capital is probably a process that will take longer. And interestingly, so far, it's mostly the duration mismatch that has created problems. But I'm wondering whether liquidity is another area that we need to look for very carefully in the context of this adjustment process. Now, in my title, I mentioned regulatory change. And clearly, I think we all agree we've had a lot of this already, but wanted to at least pick this up in the context, obviously, of sustainable investing as well, because this is a topic that is of great interest to the industry, to LGIM as well. We very strongly believe that this is the standard that we want to take forward. And not reciting what you know already in terms of what is happening, but I've picked out the idea around energy transition. And clearly, when you look at the regulatory framework in the backdrop, I think we hopefully all agree greater harmonization would be great. There's still confusion at times on what's required where and what. But again, we all, I think, are working towards a greater harmonization. To me, the interesting point is whether the products we are creating on the back of this, and again, sticking to the energy transition and net zero in particular, I think for the time being have focused very much on an exclusionary approach. Right? You can achieve a net zero aligned portfolio in excluding the dirtiest stuff. That will not change the actual problem within society. We will not address climate change by merely excluding what we think are the dirtiest companies. And so what I wanted to do actually is talk a little bit about the innovation that we have developed within LGIM, but where I believe the industry overall has a real role to play, and it's about engagement-led investment. So if we say we cannot just merely exclude the dirtiest companies, then somehow we have to help them to get to transition and to get to a more sustainable future. And this is what a specific fund we're about to launch is exactly going to do. You very clearly call out the laggards and you invest in the laggards in order to have a, with the support of engagement, to allow them to transition to where they need to be aligned to net zero. The way it works actually is relatively straightforward, and we're fully aware that transparency is key here. For us to demonstrate that engagement works, you have to be very clear at the outset what the problem statement is and what you're trying to solve for, and make sure that there is a clear path for a company to get to that outcome. And so there will be three very clear buckets in the context of the clear laggards. So we have companies that, as we know, have not developed a clear transition plan, are far away from being aligned to net zero, and obviously we're focusing on the kind of worst emitting sectors in order to have the biggest impact. Right now, it's 75% of the MSCI world that is not there yet. So you see that the problem statement we are trying to address here is actually in the interest of everyone to make it work. The other two buckets are then companies that are unloved, i.e. potentially mispriced, where already the management thinks actually that they have done everything that would get them on track and on the right transition path, but where the market has clearly not really understood that trajectory. And the last one, equally important, are the enablers. So how do we do this? Transparency is key. As I said, define the problem statement, define the transition and the actual action points you would like management to do, define the pathway, the timeline, because for us to make this visible, we have to be very clear, and I know that this is a lot of additional work, but it's an incredibly exciting path if you consider that clearly the change you could achieve with this, and to our mind, the financial return as well. Because what we're doing is not just in the context of getting companies to be aligned with net zero, but clearly if they do, there is a positive financial impact as well. So it is not that we are separating financial return from the actual change, but we believe that they actually go hand in hand. The chances that a company is not engaging, of course, is there. And you have to be, again, very clear, very visible, that if you do not engage the company, that clearly, obviously, divestment is still part of the toolbox, but not at the outset. That is the biggest difference. And the big benefit of the idea of an engagement-led model is that it applies to other themes as well. This is not just for climate, but can be easily transferred to other themes as well. But it's just for us that the understanding that how we address these problem statements cannot just be exclusionary, but has to be more forward-looking in the way how we can help more systematically. And I think that's a great step. I know there's others of our peers that have done the same thing. And I think it's a great innovation and a particularly great evolution of the way how these funds have developed. It's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for your attention and enjoy the rest of the afternoon.